fear itself. Those are the bells of victory ringing on V-Day in Westminster Abbey, London. Those are the bells of yesterday. They're only one of many sounds and voices you will hear, telling again the events of that happy time and events less jubilant which have happened since. For this is a program about that yesterday 5 years ago, but also about today and fear and tomorrow.
United Nations Radio presents Fear Itself, a special program narrated by Martin Gable.
This is yesterday, May 8th, 1945. Soldiers on the battlefronts of Europe rest their guns. In the Pacific, there's no rest yet for the fighting man. But across the other half of the world, bells are ringing. Streets are filled. Phone lines jammed. Bomb shelters empty. Where were you 5 years ago? Turn the dial of your radio back to the night of May 8th, 1945. You place it? I remember well enough where I was. In a radio studio. We were celebrating in our own way.
We're gonna tell the postman next time he comes around that Mr. Hitler's new address is the Berlin Burying Ground. Round and around Hitler's grave, round and around we go. Gonna lay that feller down so he won't get up no more. Hitler went to the Russian front where every bullet missed him, but he caused a dose of Stalingrad that spread all through his system.
Round and around Hitler's grave, round and around we go. Gonna lay that feller down, he won't get up no more.
There are many variations on this melody tonight. Many a different tongue and tune saying the same thing. The Serbs would refer to it as
Obilashimo, okolo, nokolo, itrovo grova, okolo, nokolo.
And the Danes
Ogstagavi rundum, Hitler's grave, Hitler's grave, Hitler's grave.
The Greeks have a word for it.
Giro stomni matu, Hitler giro giro, pername, pername.
Yes, and the note of triumph was echoed by Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Englishmen, Russians, in city and village and farm. Listen now to the real thing. For joy is good to hear again, good any time. Let us now, following geographical progression, go east first and work west with the clock. Between Moscow on the east and Guam in the west, there arcs a latitude of joy and comradeship half a world wide. A chain of linked hopes, hurrahs, and hallelujahs. Listen to the sounds of Moscow back then, in the good old days. V.E. Day plus one. Here is the English-speaking announcer in that city as he opened the microphones on what sounds like a steady roar, but is actually the sound of 2,000 saluting cannons intermingled with the bells of the Kremlin.
Listen now to 2,000 guns proclaiming Russian Victory Day.
Moscow, Red Square, Russians yelling, dancing in the streets, mobbing the American embassy, grabbing GIs, hugging them, tossing them into the air, toasting them in English and in vodka. 5 years from this time, Stalin's photograph, on display with other stills outside a newsreel theater in New York City, will be attacked by an angry customer. Americans will be strictly unwelcome in Moscow. But on VE night, the world listens eagerly to the Soviet leader when he comes on the air. The great day of victory has come, he says. Fascist Germany has been brought to her knees by the Red Army and the troops of our allies. The period of war in Europe has ended. The period of peaceful development has begun. Now a British lady visiting in Moscow brings her husband's greetings to the Russian people in this hour. Her name is Mrs. Churchill, and her husband has asked her to say,
"It is my firm belief that on friendship and understanding between the British and Russian people depends the future of mankind."
The Muscovites dance, cheer, pray, weep, sing songs of their own, songs of their comrades in arms. They even try Tipperary, and it comes over the short wave with only the slightest accent of speech and atmosphere. It was a long, longer way to Berlin for the Russians than it ever was from anywhere to Tipperary. But on the night of victory, radio gets there fast enough. It brings the voice of Howard K. Smith speaking to the combined American networks from among ruins representing combined American-British-Russian marksmanship.
A bronze bust of Hitler with a bullet hole through its forehead lay in the dusty ruins down in the cellar. The Fuhrer's garden had apparently been fought for, too. There was not a patch of green on its pocked, scarred surface.
Not all is destruction in the city. Some building is being done this very day.
Now, right in the middle of the map of Berlin, in the Tiergarten, a monument is being erected. It was half finished this morning when we passed. It's a tribunal of many columns, and in Russian characters on each column is printed the name of a Nazi victim. Austria, Czechoslovakia, Norway, Denmark, and so on. It's a monument to the United Nations, and it's Russian.
On this day, everybody on the winning side is patting everybody else on the back. Even the inmates of Belsen add a trembling note of thanks for liberation. A British commentator calls it one of the most touching experiences of the day.
Perhaps the most touching was the playing of God Save the King in our honor on the rickety and out-of-tune piano in the SS canteen which the liberated prisoners had taken over. Listen.
Also in Belsen, there is other significant music. A British chaplain holds a Jewish service, for freedom of religion has come with the liberation. A handful of Jews have strength to sing. BBC man, some 35,000 corpses around him, describes the place on VE Day.
When we reached the camp, there were 35,000 corpses on the ground. In the first days of liberation, thousands more died, many of them from sheer joy at liberation. We were burying them in mass graves. One I saw was not quite so large as a tennis court and 20 foot deep. It was half full. For the first two or three days, the burials, even on this scale, could not catch up with the deaths. It was hard to tell between the living and the dead. People lay down and died before your eyes. A skeleton amidst the skeletons would suddenly begin to move and crawl away.
He takes some Dutch children from the camp, takes them as far from the corpses as he can get, 50 yards into a grove of pines and young birch trees, and there they sing. Everybody who has enough strength sings. These Dutch kids, just out of prison, voice their appreciation to the British soldiers who've liberated them. The English, the words say, long live the English.
Long live the labor, long live the labor, long live the labor in the holy year, in the holy year, in
BBC, standing amid corpses, the speciality of the Nazis, asks some questions.
What is the meaning of these things? What are we to do about them? These questions are not easy to answer. I have seen at first hand the horrors you have heard and seen at second hand. We must revenge these things. We must, in a great act of world justice, punish and trample upon this evil. We must harden our hearts to mercy. We all feel that. But there is something else. We must not wreak indiscriminate vengeance.
He's certain of one thing.
The camp, when it has been finally cleared, will be burned and blotted from the face of the earth.
It is still to be there in 1950, with DPs living in it. But we're getting ahead of our story. Our little chapter in history moves on now to Paris on that VE night, 5 years ago, to a city where people know how to celebrate. Rockets rise from the city of light, red, white, and blue. On the streets, GIs line up in snake dances, go surging up the Champs-Élysées, on and up to the Arc de Triomphe. The singing comes into the great circle from all directions, from all the spoke-like avenues. Now, westward across the beaches of Normandy, across the chop and rip of the Channel, the tide of jubilation sweeps to Britain. Westminster Abbey sounds her bells. In Piccadilly, Trafalgar Square, all over London town and the British Isles, there's gaiety. Now the people stop in their merriment and listen silently to the voice of their king.
There is great comfort in the thought that the years of darkness and danger in which the children of our country have grown up are over, and please God, forever. We shall have failed, and the blood of our dearest will have flowed in vain, if the victory which they died to win does not lead to a lasting peace founded on justice and goodwill.
The words are for Britain, but their meaning is for the world. And so is the hooting of the ships in the harbor of Liverpool and Merseyside and Hull. Now Tommy Atkins throngs in hollering thousands to Whitehall. He knows whom he wants to hear now. Listen to the BBC commentator.
And now, oh, what wonderful luck. At this moment,
Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony.
It's the same PM who earlier in the day announced to his countrymen the news of victory and paid special tribute to his two great allies, to America and the West.
The overwhelming power and resources of the United States of America.
And then a salute to the Russians in the East.
Our heroic Russian comrades, whose prowess in the field has been one of the grand contributions to the general victory.
And from Paris, British Air Marshal Cunningham first praises the American Air Force, then, addressing the combined air forces of the United Nations, points to the future with a sense of prophecy.
You are in truth a total of 12 nations, but how happily and successfully we have worked as one. If and when you are worried at world events, remember our year together and its triumphant ending, and draw strength from what you have done.
His words tumble down the years. And if and when you're worried at world events, remember the years together and our triumphs. And tonight we are worried, Marshal Cunningham. And we are trying to remember. But we're still back 5 years ago, and rejoicing sweeps across the Atlantic like a tidal wave to the very pavements of Times Square.
To our right, in front of the Times building, a large crowd is gathering. It seems to be growing larger by the minute. A lot of people are up there watching the various bulletins which are being posted upon the windows. And we can see people looking from windows.
The city's best-loved voice, now testy, now cajoling, cautions New Yorkers that fighting may still be going on in parts of Europe and is certainly continuing in the Pacific.
Perhaps they're fighting someplace. I don't know. You don't know. Why be childish about it? Now let's be patient for a few hours and then let us commemorate it in a way fitting. A great people of a great democracy having millions of men still at war in the Pacific.
And in the nation's capital, the new commander-in-chief, only a few weeks in office.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. We must work to bind up the wounds of a suffering world, to build an abiding peace, a peace rooted in justice and in law. We can build such a peace only by hard, toilsome, painstaking work, by understanding and working with our allies in peace as we have in war.
Northward from Washington, in the city of brotherly love, America's best beloved bell tolls again. Its voice is cracked.
From the historic shrine of American Liberty, Independence Hall in Philadelphia, you have just heard the seven strokes of the Liberty Bell. The bell which tolled out the word of America's freedom back in 1776. The bell which since then has marked each historic step of American history. And today the Liberty Bell rings out again, this time to proclaim to the world freedom for the occupied countries of Europe.
And back in New York at Fordham University, Father Gannon offers a prayer in warning and in hope. Behind him, waiting, stands a chorus ready to sing the Te Deum.
Peace is not an automatic blessing that comes when the guns have been silenced. It is a task that has to be wrestled with. God grant in his mercy that this hour of splendid victory will prove in time to have been the first step toward a still more splendid peace.
Te Deum laudamus.
In Cleveland, the shining promise of peace makes people silent, makes friends of strangers.
We saw men coming together, total strangers, and most of them in work clothes, going to or coming from their war jobs. Well, they smiled at each other, shook hands silently, and just went on their way.
The farther westward you go, the more you realize VE Day is not the end, just a pause. Toward that final end, in San Francisco, the United Nations are charting the course for the future this very day. One of the men whose minds are on tomorrow is General Smuts of South Africa.
Here in San Francisco, the United Nations hope to work out a plan which will, we trust, succeed in laying the broad foundations on which an enduring peace with justice and honor can be built for the world in future.
There's the word of today for the world of tomorrow. Peace with justice and honor. How to build it? The MP guard at the conference hall has a recipe.
Stick all the delegates in one room and leave them fight it out until it's all over and settled.
6,000 miles beyond that, a tired newsman sits in a radio shack on Guam. No bells, no speeches, no torn paper, not even prayers. Just wondering, he says.
Wondering once again if people are making fools of themselves, unintentionally, but hopefully. That is the reaction here. No one wants to be fooled anymore in the Pacific. I think I speak for every man down here when I say, thank God if it's over there. Let us hope we can get together now and finish it over here.
And the day ends thus. Not with a bang, but with a wonder. The celebration is over, but not the war. 3 months from victory in Europe, 2 atomic bombs are dropped on Japanese cities. And by the time the poisonous mushrooms of both have been pulled apart by high-flying winds, 120,000 people are dead of the effect. And then inevitably, the surrender. Aboard the Missouri, the masters of Japan stand ready to sign on the dotted line as the supreme commander of the Allied forces in the Pacific says into a microphone,
"Representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored."
And so, World War II is, on paper at least, officially ended. But as someone said on VE Night,
"Peace has a mind of its own and doesn't follow victory around. What is two-thirds finished in Germany won't be three-thirds finished in Japan."
The peace of 1945 certainly has a mind of its own. And it's a neurotic mind, soon to develop symptoms. Not immediately, but soon enough. In the Middle East, a new war is brewing. In China, civil war. Indonesia, revolution. India, religious massacres. Crises in the Balkans, South America, Iran. But above all, snags running east and west. A spy trial in Canada, another in Bulgaria. Objections, complaints, a split in the voting at UN, not yet become chronic. And then, right down the middle, in the hot inner circle of fear itself, the reminder midway through 1946 that something new has been permanently added to the classic instruments of violence and death, the first experimental A-bomb. Tens of millions tune their radios to Operation Crossroads in the Pacific, where aboard an American battleship, the seconds to zero hour are counted off amid excitement and confusion.
Firing time.
How it will sound?
20 seconds.
We do not know how it's going to sound, but 42,000 men here are watching, tensely awaiting that explosion.
Firing time.
All of the observer ships.
10 seconds.
All of the observer ships are in position in the open sea. We're about 10 miles away.
Fire the target. 4, 3, 2, 1.
The great executioner roars its warning, and listeners with enough imagination shudder in their chairs. In the meantime, lesser executioners do their work. Lord Haw Haw is hanged in England. Quisling, who has given his name forever to the vocabulary of ratting, is shot like a rat in Norway. Kramer, beast of Belsen, swings in Germany. The main criminals among the Japanese brass are disposed of. Later come the grand executions in Nuremberg. The men who are going to win for Adolf Hitler 1,000 years of fascist supremacy are exterminated like petty murderers in a little over an hour. East and West agree on that much anyway. The last remarks of Joachim von Ribbentrop are reported by radio correspondent Arthur Gaith, who witnessed the hangings.
"It was 1:11 when the pale, exhausted, slightly disheveled, brown-suited 53-year-old worshipper of the Führer stood at the door, was uncuffed, led to the foot of the stairs where his hands were bound. Upon request, he repeated his name. Slowly, the 13 stairs were mounted. Ribbentrop responded strangely to the permission given to make a last statement. He spoke intently, and I quote, 'God protect Germany. God have mercy on my soul. My last wish is that German unity be maintained, that understanding between East and West be realized, and there be peace for the world.'" End of quote.
End of Ribbentrop. The worst offenders among the vanquished enemy are dead. But the undercurrent of conflict among the victors had already come close to the surface. Winston Churchill, a visitor in Fulton, Missouri, delivers a speech in which, for the first time, the phrase "Iron Curtain" makes its appearance.
"From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent."
He points a rhetorical finger directly at the Soviet Union.
"A shadow has fallen upon the scenes so lately lighted by the Allied victory. Nobody knows what Soviet Russia and its Communist International Organization intends to do in the immediate future? Or what are the limits, if any, to their expansive and proselytizing tendencies?
It is less than 300 days since the end of the war in Europe. Yet there are prophecies that a new war is inevitable, even imminent. Mr. Churchill doesn't think so.
I repulse the idea that a new war is inevitable, still more that it is imminent. I do not believe that Soviet Russia desires war.
After Fulton comes protests from the East. But in spite of everything, there are still, by the first anniversary of VE Day, some traces of tolerance and mutual respect left over from the victory. It's not so long ago that Premier Stalin, in a message to President Truman on the death of Franklin Roosevelt, said,
"In Franklin Roosevelt, the American people and the United Nations have lost the greatest political leader of world scope and the herald of peace and security after the war. The Soviet Union expresses its sincere sympathies with the American people in its grave bereavement and expresses also its confidence that the policy of collaboration among the great powers, which carried the brunt of the war against the common enemy, will be strengthened in the future."
And there are cordial exchanges from the West to East, too, on the occasion of a Soviet anniversary. There are shadows, but the landscape is not yet dark. American newspaper and radio correspondents still have business addresses inside Russia. And Radio Moscow still calls across the sea.
This is Radio Center Moscow. You've been listening to Farnsworth Powell speaking from Moscow for the Columbia Broadcasting System. Hello, NBC. Robert Magadov begins at 10 minutes past the hour Moscow time. This is Radio Center Moscow.
Voices on both sides of the Atlantic call for control of atomic energy. Bernard Baruch makes a proposal, later rejected by the Russians. He warms up to the subject with these words.
My fellow members of the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission and my fellow citizens of the world, we are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead. That is our business. Behind the black portent of the new atomic age lies a hope which, seized upon with faith, can work our salvation. If we fail, then we have damned every man to be the slave of fear.
Slaves of fear indeed. Disagreement about the way to control the atom. But still, moderation in debate. And only mild insults in the press and on the radios of East and West. The phrase Cold War has not yet been invented. The Mr. Magadov, recently announced by Radio Moscow, has not yet been expelled as an alleged American spy. In this same year, 1946, a foreign radio man is permitted for the first time to record interviews with ordinary citizens inside Russia. On a collective farm, a woman speaks into an American microphone, and a man at her elbow interprets for her in broken English.
First of all, she wants to tell all the peoples of the world must be friends. They must be good friends. And she doesn't want, and nobody wants to see such a great war as we had with fascism, Germany.
A little Russian girl steps up and volunteers to sing a song to her friends in America. A song she learned from a movie.
Мы друзья, перелетные птицы, только быть наш одним нехорош. На земле не успели жениться, но на небе жены не найдешь. Потому что мы пилоты. Небо наш родимый дом. Первым делом самолеты. Ну, а девушки потом. Первым делом самолеты.
This fragment of Russian music is later played on the American radio. And in Russia, the work of modern American composers is played on the national radio.
Thank you.
American art exhibition is held in Moscow and praised by the Russians. An American chess team visits Russia and is warmly welcomed. Russia's top atomic scientist is awarded a foreign associate membership by the United States National Academy of Sciences. President Truman cordially receives the new Soviet ambassador, tells him that the traditional and long-standing friendship between our two peoples was sealed by the blood of our valiant sons. Still, there's already a strong undercurrent in the tide. Russia's top movie director, the late Serge Eisenstein, then ailing of a heart disease, is asked when he's going to visit the United States again. He replies with caution, noting that all is not sweetness and light between the two countries.
Well, it's difficult to say that, and it depends not only of my work, which will take a lot of time, but also, and even more than that, of the atmosphere of friendship which will be between our countries. I don't want to visit a hostile America. I was always a great enthusiast of Soviet-American friendship. And I hope that the friendship and relationship will continue after this period where it is not too friendly.
Not too friendly is soon to become the understatement of the decade. Before the middle of the year, the same Premier Stalin, who a year ago spoke confidently of collaboration among the great powers, says in an order of the day,
"We should not forget for a single minute the intrigues of international reaction, which is hatching plans for a new war. The armed forces of the Soviet Union must daily improve their military art."
By August, American Secretary of State Burns accuses the former ally of repeated abuse and misrepresentation, but not before he's told the American people to be patient about the making of peace and reminded them of their own history.
After every great war, the victors find the making of peace difficult and disappointing. It took the 13 American states more than 5 years after winning their independence to agree upon a constitution which promised anything like a durable peace among themselves. To build world peace requires even greater tolerance, patience, and understanding. It requires the will and ability to seek the best, to accept the best obtainable, and then to make the best obtainable work. As war breeds war, so peace can be made to breed peace.
Only a year since the shooting ended in Japan, and their shooting in the sky over Tito's Yugoslavia. American flyers charged with disregarding a warning to land are killed in the incident. Now the tempo steps up. The propaganda, which has been steady from Russia but more sporadic from the West, now pours from both sides. Meanwhile, the work of the United Nations goes on in spite of all obstacles. It clears up troubles elsewhere in the world, restores order to war-torn Europe, stops epidemics, feeds millions, resettles displaced persons. Soon enough, it will show its power in negotiation. It will put a stop to no less than 3 hot wars: Kashmir, Palestine, Indonesia. But the Cold War, the East-West dispute, drags on, often inside the UN, mostly outside of it. It flares up, quiets down, flares up again. And crossing the ether above Lake Success, a barrage of propaganda and counter-propaganda. The Voice of America opens a new campaign to reach Russian listeners.
Говорит Нью-Йорк, Соединенные Штаты Америки, одна из объединенных наций. Голос Америки обращается к слушателям в Советском Союзе. Мелодия, которую вы только что прослушали, американская патриотическая песня «Янки Дудл».
After 2 years of these broadcasts, Soviet transmitters meet the Voice of America at the frontier with the sound of jamming.
To our broadcast of the Voice of the United States of America in the 19, 25, 31, and 49 minutes.
But we're again ahead of our story. In March 1947, the Congress of the United States approves the Truman Doctrine, described by its author as a means to supply financial and military aid against the spread of totalitarianism.
I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. The world is not static, and the status quo is not sacred. But we cannot allow changes in the status quo in violation of the Charter of the United Nations by such methods as coercion or by subterfuges as political infiltration. In helping free and independent nations to maintain their freedom, the United States will be giving effect to the principles of the Charter of the United Nations.
Congress votes to implement the doctrine. A few days later, there's a coup, a shake-up in Hungary, and a pro-communist government is installed. Bulgaria executes an opposition leader convicted of treason. The United States and Britain protest. Greece arrests thousands of its citizens on grounds that they're plotting a communist revolution. War talk waggles like danger signals at a crossing. In the General Assembly of the United Nations, Vyshinsky demands action against warmongering.
The Soviet delegation proposes the adoption of the following resolution. The United Nations condemn the criminal propaganda for a new war carried on by reactionary circles in a number of countries, and in particular in the United States of America, Turkey, and Greece, and deem it essential that the governments of all countries be called upon to prohibit, on pain of criminal penalties, the carrying on of war propaganda in any form.
There's talk of getting tough on both sides, and then more than talk. A communist government seizes power in Czechoslovakia. Russia establishes a blockade of Berlin. Where once American and Russian troops embraced each other, where there was comradeship of arms, there is now distrust, roadblocks, and the comradeship of fear itself. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Trygve Lie, eyeing the conflict from the vantage point of his high post, quotes from President Roosevelt's famous phrase about the fear of fear.
People are afraid in America. They are afraid in Russia. They are afraid in small countries like my own. I think that if we are going to make the United Nations work and prevent another war, we shall have to begin by a reaffirmation of the courageous faith for which Franklin D. Roosevelt stood. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. There should be an end to war talk. I do not believe any government anywhere in the world is so utterly mad as to contemplate starting another war.
But fear itself is at the controls, and gestures of defiance from both sides are as thick as airplanes at Tempelhof. A typical broadcast from Berlin during the era of the airlift brings the voice of Alan Jackson reporting.
America and the Western powers are going to stay in Berlin. Our airlift operation over the Russian blockade lines is going to be increased, and furthermore, it's going to be maintained, regardless of what happens in the corridors leading into this isolated city.
The blockade goes on, and debate and acrimony go with it. Then, by one of those little ironies without which life would be considerably duller, a Soviet product becomes vastly popular in the United States. A musical suite by the Soviet composer Kachaturian becomes the number one best-selling classical album in America. And its appeal is so great that Woody Herman records a pop tune arrangement that spins in tens of thousands of jukeboxes throughout the land. Music goes round and round, and so does the trouble. Mrs. Kosenkina jumps from the window of the Soviet consulate in New York. The United States demands the recall of the Soviet Consul General Lamakin for what it terms abuse of his position in connection with the case. And on his way out of the country, Lamakin brushes past questioning reporters at the dockside.
I ordered my tickets about 2 months ago.
Well, why did you do that, sir?
Because I was going to take a rest.
You were going to take a rest,
and
Mr.
now
Lamakin.
I have nothing to say.
A Moscow conference on the Berlin situation breaks up without agreement. And in Berlin itself, where the airlift is now droning along in its 8th month, something else breaks up. The towers of Radio Berlin, used by Soviets for broadcasting, are dynamited by the French military government, in whose zone the towers are situated. The French say the towers interfered with the airlift operation. The Russians protest and go on broadcasting over other facilities. The Cold War begins to freeze to the marrow any hopes that had started out warm. But early in 1949, there's an exchange between Moscow and Washington which punctuates the strange history of these days.
Main headline, New York Times, January 31st, 1949.
Stalin says he is not averse to a meeting with Truman. Washington view cautious. Disarmament mentioned. He says Russia is prepared to consider a joint peace statement with U.S.
3 days later, there's an official statement in Washington, and the same New York Times carries the headline,
Truman bars negotiations with Soviet outside UN. Still would receive Stalin. Two-power deal out. President bans talks, ignoring world body, even if others join. Remarks that he would have Mrs. Truman prepare room if Russian accepted bid.
No room is prepared. No caviar to the generalissimo ordered in the White House kitchen. The fog drifts in again, and it's cold outside. The Allies put up a counter-blockade in Berlin. Cardinal Mincenti is convicted of treason in Hungary. United States demands investigation of reported Russian slave labor. General Clay expels a Soviet mission from the American zone of Germany. The USSR challenges American intentions in Iran. And so it goes, like a tennis match. The ball loaded with danger is batted back and forth across the net of the Times. Three great events punctuate 1949. First is the signing of the North Atlantic Pact, upon which occasion President Truman says,
In this treaty, we seek to establish freedom from aggression and from the use of force in the North Atlantic community. This is the area which has been at the heart of the last two world conflicts. To protect this area against war will be a long step toward permanent peace in the whole world. There are those who claim that this treaty is an aggressive act on the part of the nations which ring the North Atlantic. That is absolutely untrue.
The Soviet reply is reported by United Nations Radio in its daily news service, Mr. Gromyko's speech being translated.
The signatories to the North Atlantic Pact are taking widespread military measures which cannot be justified by the interests of these countries' defense. How would the United States react to the establishment by some great power located several thousand miles from the United States of air bases, say, on the territory of Mexico? Obviously, the United States would not be inclined to regard such an action as a matter of self-defense.
But if this is another rent in the fabric of East-West relations, there is soon a patch, a big patch. The Berlin crisis is mended not in the air over Germany, but in the delegates' lounge of the United Nations at Lake Success, after informal talks between American and Russian diplomats. On the mutual newsreel, after its standard fanfare, comes the good news.
The blockade ends in Berlin. The red barriers around Berlin come down, and 16 Allied trains loaded with freight and passengers roll eastward into the Soviet sector. Autos, horse-drawn carts, bicycles, and wheelbarrows crowd the roads. In the city itself, Mutual's Henry LaCosset tells us...
This is Henry LaCosset in Berlin. The lights are going on in Berlin, West Berlin, that is. They're going on after being out at this time of night for everybody for about a year.
4 years from the end of the war in Europe. It's a sudden shaft of bright sunshine, but it doesn't last long. The sky remains generally overcast, like the sometimes tedious weather of a North Atlantic spring. Then another big story in the news. Russia has the A-bomb. The announcement does not issue from the Kremlin, but from the White House.
and reaction in Washington is instantaneous. Brian McMahon, chairman of the Congressional Atomic Energy Committee, says,
"The Kremlin will bargain for universal peace in its own time and on its own terms. That is, if the Kremlin wants peace at all. We must alert the entire civilized world to the peril which the Kremlin policy involves. We must employ to the utmost every channel of diplomacy which yields the slightest hope of finding a way out of the impasse."
Congressman Battle of the House Foreign Affairs Committee takes a calm view of the affair.
"I don't think that we need to be panicking. I don't believe that it means war. But certainly it heightens the tension that already exists. And we must keep a level head, make our decisions, base them on understanding and reason, and not on a basis of hysteria."
But not always are heads kept level. Not always do understanding and reason rule over hysteria. The events that have occurred since that news last fall are still too fresh in everybody's memory to recall here. Some of them perhaps too painful to recall. But throughout these days, the constant toe-to-toe slugging in the council chambers, fear and hysteria and witch hunts on both sides, hundreds of people in the East and West tried and convicted for treason and lesser charges growing out of the battle of the ideologies. And on top of it all, hundreds of phrases, thousands of rebukes, allegations, insults traded like blows. Here now, without invention of any kind, are a few actual phrases from official statements, spoken in meetings whose purpose was to find answers, to seek solutions, to make settlements. A Soviet delegate.
"Distortions, slanders, libels."
American delegate.
"Innocent, sweet-sounding propaganda maneuver."
Soviet.
"Nothing but camouflage."
British.
"Constant repetition of untruths."
Soviet.
"A black plot for a new war is being hatched."
American.
"Russian people are receiving from the official press and radio a mixture of hatred, abuse, and untruth."
Soviet.
"The USA and the United Kingdoms only give out some kind of a whine."
Canadian.
"The yoke of Soviet domination."
Soviet.
"We cannot consider these pygmies as a delegation."
Australia.
"Such a charge is ridiculous."
Soviet.
"Threaten to kindle a new war, to exterminate the people of Soviet cities and towns, to devastate our cities and towns."
Canadian.
"The customary Soviet practice of picking and choosing blood-curdling stories and reports from the free Western press."
Soviet.
"An exceptionally dirty and slanderous document."
American.
"Unlawful and hostile actions."
Soviet.
"The notorious Truman Doctrine propaganda poison."
British.
"Complete travesty of the facts. Effrontery."
Soviet.
"The warmongers run around loose, unpunished, and conduct their criminal work."
4 years of non-cooperation and obstruction by the Soviet Union.
"Rotting regime."
"Bellicose utterances."
"Anglo-American capitalist monopoly."
"Effrontery."
"Selfish calculation."
"Name-calling." "A poor battle."
"Broken pledges."
"Political reverse."
"White fence."
And so, the greatest powers on earth bethump each other in the assembly hall and conference chamber, and the sound and sense reflect from the hard surfaces of press and radio. They're amplified and magnified until they conglomerate in a roar vying with that of the underwater affair of Bikini. But throwing names into debate is better than throwing men into battle. Dynamite sticks break bones, but names never hurt more than feelings. Perhaps there's something in the fact that in all the years leading up to the very eve of war between Nazi Germany and the United States, only the mildest kind of official language, firm but polite, was exchanged between the two countries. Never anything approaching the slam-bang you've just listened to. Perhaps letting off steam, even if noisy, does prevent explosive pressure from quietly building up inside. Nevertheless, steam can only mean that fires are burning. And every fresh maneuver, every fresh attack and counterattack, adds to the danger, tightens the grip of fear, raises the temperature of the Cold War, delays any end of it. But where can a Cold War end? Can either side win it? Both sides are worried about that. The people and their leaders are worried. The President of the General Assembly of the United Nations is worried, too. And he has something to say about it. Here's General Carlos Romulo of the Philippines, specially addressing this program.
I see in the press and hear on the radio statements sometimes about winning the Cold War. This, in my opinion, is a tragic misconception. Neither side, I'm afraid, can win the Cold War without automatically touching off a hot war. There is only one combination that can win the Cold War. That is the United Nations. The choice is rapidly becoming either peaceful negotiation through the United Nations or the unimaginably horrible negotiation of mass murder on the battlegrounds of an atomic war.
And the nature of atomic war is grimly understood. Also, the lack of guarantee that the battleground might not be your own street, your own home, wherever you may be throughout the world. Amateurs may speculate on this, but the experts agree. At intervals between incidents in the Cold War have come their voices prophesying doom, warning not alone the parties at dispute, but all mankind. The scientists at the famous Chicago Roundtable Conference announcing...
The hydrogen bomb could be made to exterminate the world's entire population.
Albert Einstein, in a broadcast, saying...
Annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibilities.
Dr. Vannevar Bush saying...
There is no defense against an airborne A-bomb. It is almost impossible to design an atom bomb-proof building.
Dr. Harrison Brown.
Scientists are not exaggerating when they say that all human life could be destroyed by a hydrogen bomb.
Warnings. Warnings against the cataclysm of a hot war. From scientists, statesmen, workers, farmers, mothers and wives, from the corridors of the UN, from East and West, from the backs of men's minds everywhere. Fear of war, hate of war, horror of war, but also talk of war. People ask burning questions.
What can be done?
People ask...
Is it all going to happen again?
People ask...
How do we get out of this mess?
Various answers are given. From one quarter comes the suggestion...
Scrap the United Nations.
From another...
Dissolve the United Nations and reorganize it without the Eastern Nations.
Few men rise in the forums of the world to address themselves either to those fearful questions or their equally fearful answers.
United Nations Information Center, New Delhi, India, to United Nations Radio, Lake Success. In reply your query, following statement received, Prime Minister Pandit Nehru, quote, "The whole conception of one world, however distant that one world may be, involves an organization like the United Nations. However difficult the path, it has to be pursued by repeated attempts at cooperation between all nations. Once that attempt is given up, the consequence can only be preparation for conflict on a world scale and the conflict itself. If any attempt is made to change the present nature of the United Nations, it will not lead to another or more powerful organization which can work for peace. It would only mean the breakup of something that is actually and potentially valuable, with nothing to take its place."
Secretary General of the United Nations, Trygve Lie, rises to speak in Paris, where he's in the midst of still another mission to bridge the gulf between East and West.
When the United Nations was established in San Francisco, it was created as an organization for the entire world. Now it is proposed to split the world permanently into two camps. That road will harden existing divisions in the world, create new ones, perpetuate and accelerate the armaments race, make economic warfare a permanent condition, condemn all the poor and hungry to remaining poor and hungry, bring the propaganda war and its accompanying hysteria to new depths of intellectual and moral degradation, and destroy the chance for agreement on control of atomic energy.
There is in radio a custom sometimes followed of playing music behind a recollected speech of some importance. Here are a few words recollected from as recently as May 3rd, 1950. A few brief words, but perhaps they are graver and of more importance to us than any we have heard in these last five fear-ridden years. Supply to these words your own background. Compose your own memory of wars past and fill in your imagination of the future under this voice which warns of split camps.
There is only one possible end to that road. Sooner or later, a third world war. The other road is the United Nations. That road leads away from a third world war instead of towards it.
Wherever you are in the world, whatever the color of your flag, the pigment of your skin, the shade of your ideology, there is one thing as fixed as the polar star. Deep down, beneath whatever political creed you follow, you want peace. If that is so, then you must be very certain that the only way to achieve it is through the United Nations. This is the advice of the man who, as much as any man in the world, probably more, has lived intimately with the problems of peace and war. This is the message of the Secretary General of the United Nations. The choice is clear now. It's either patience, either the 20-year program of negotiation through the United Nations, for which he is called, or else it is a split, a continuation of the Cold War, and ultimate hot war. The Cold War at the outset was a product of fear. To extend it further will be to give fear itself the final triumph, to give it the last word. And the last word would be silence. The silence of dead cities cooking in radioactive debris. The silence of corpses whose empty eyes look on the final irony of our civilization.
They did not have the patience to negotiate.
The night grows older. It's 5 years since the day of victory in Europe. Where shall we be? Any of us, all of us, 5 years from this night. Shall the bells of jubilation which sounded 5 years ago be a mockery 5 years from now? Shall we hear them sitting on the crater's edge of fear? Or shall they find again their own true pitch and rhythm and ring again for total victory? The victory of man over his ancient, overburdened tendency to kill his fellow man. The victory of rightness over wrath. Of reason over fear itself.
United Nations Radio has presented a special transcribed program entitled Fear Itself. Martin Gable, distinguished actor of stage and screen, was the narrator. Historical records heard in the course of the program were from the libraries of the National American Networks, the British Broadcasting Corporation, and from the archives of various government agencies. Fear Itself was prepared and produced by United Nations Radio.